The Joyful Friar podcast is made possible by the generous support of our friends. To support the podcast, please visit nathan-castle.com and donate today. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Joyful Friar podcast. I'm Father Nathan Castle, your host. And today I'm thrilled to have with us one of the founders or bright lights in the field of near-death studies. That's Dr. Bruce Grayson. We're so grateful that you have chosen to be with us today, Dr. Grayson.
Well, thank you so much, Father Nathan, for inviting me.
Sure. Well, I'm going to read just a little bit of the standard intro that I think accompanies most any interview you do or whatever. You're currently a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia. And your most recent book, I think, the most recent one is After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. I'd like to hear a little bit in this interview, just for my own benefit, about the work you co-edited, The Handbook of Near-Death Experiences, back in 2009. Mm-hmm. I know that you've written many journal articles, and you're not difficult to find online. Anybody that wants to know about Dr. Grayson after this little, I think of these interviews as something like an infomercial. We give a tease of who this person is, and if you think like you're more interested in knowing about them, you'll at least know somebody new to go search for. You've been referred to as the father of research in near-death experiences. Does that make you sound like a statue? Or
there are several of us who've been called that. I'm not sure I can take sole title to that.
All right. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. That's probably true of a lot of things where somebody becomes the father of something. There's probably a lot of people that helped do whatever it is.
Sure.
You've created a scale to measure the aspects of near-death experiences that's been widely used. And I'd like it if you commented a little
on that. Sure.
And then I subscribe to the Journal of Near-Death Studies, and you edited that for a really long time. Was it about 20 years maybe that you did that?
Yeah, 27 years.
27. All right. So, sound off. Tell us about, I'm always interested, especially, I'm the oldest I've ever been today at 67, going on 68. And so I begin to be a little retrospective about my own life, but I'm always interested when I get to talk to people my age or older. You're about a decade older than I am. You must have some sort of a retrospective sense about you, even if you're fully engaged in your present moment and excited about your future. When you look back upon the story of you, what surprises you about it?
Well, it surprises me that I've lived this long. But I'm surprised that I got into this field at all. I was raised in a scientific household. My father was a chemist. And as far as I knew, when I was growing up, the physical world was all there was. There wasn't any spiritual or religious tradition in my family. We just grew up with the physical world. And, you know, when you die, and that's the end of it. And that was not a scary thought to us. That's just the way life is. You know, we saw animals die and so forth. So I went through college and medical school with that mindset that what you see is what you get. And in the first weeks of my psychiatric training after medical school, I was confronted with a patient that I was asked to see in the emergency room who had overdosed. And when I went to see her, she was unconscious. So I couldn't really interview her. I could not arouse her. But her roommate who had brought her in was waiting to see me in another room down the hall. So I went down to there and I talked to the roommate for about 20, 30 minutes and then sent her on her way and went back to see the patient, and she was still unconscious. So we admitted her to the intensive care unit overnight. When I saw her first thing in the morning, she was barely awake. I could arouse her. And I started to introduce myself and she stopped me and said, "I know who you are. I remember seeing you last night." That kind of surprised me. So I said something like, "Gee, I thought you were out cold when I saw you last night." And she said, "Not in my room. I saw you talking to Susan down the hall." Well, that just blew me away. I couldn't understand what she was talking about. The only way that she could have done that is she had left her body and followed me down the hall. And clearly that can't happen. You are your body. How can you leave it?
Yes.
So I was sort of fumbling around. What do I do next? and she saw that I was confused. So she started to tell me about the conversation I had with the roommate, all the questions I asked, all her answers, what we were wearing, what the room looked like, and so forth. And I just didn't know where to go with this. I thought, well, somebody's playing a trick on me. This can't be true. But I didn't have time to deal with that. I was there to deal with her confusion, not mine. So I kind of pushed into the back of my mind and talked with her about her suicidal thoughts and so forth. And I just sort of figured, well, someday I'll have time to think about all this stuff. And in the next couple of years, I met other patients of mine who had come close to death, often by suicide, but not always, and claimed to have seen things and heard things that they shouldn't have been able to when they were unconscious. They had basically what we now call near-death experiences. There was no name for them back then, so I didn't really know what these things were.
What year are you talking about when the story of the woman that you just related?
1970, and then for the next few years in the early 70s. So I assume that since these were all psychiatric patients, it had to be some type of mental illness.
Yeah.
And then in 1975, one of my colleagues at the University of Virginia, Raymond Moody, published a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term near-death experience and described what they were like. And that was my first indication that these weren't happening to just psychiatric patients, but they're happening to perfectly normal people of all different types.
Yes.
So I figured, well, I can't make sense of this, but I'm a scientist. So what do you do when you don't understand something? You don't run away from it, pretend it isn't there. You try to study it and understand what's going on here.
Yes.
So I figured I better start collecting these cases, assuming that I would soon find a simple physiological explanation for them. So I started collecting cases, and here I am 50 years later, still trying to understand what these things are all about.
I was wondering, when you were describing that woman's story, did you record anything or make any notes? Because counselors are always making notes. Did you do that?
Well, I did make some notes, but they didn't involve that. I just wrote notes about her mental status and her suicidal thoughts and so forth.
Yeah.
But I was kind of embarrassed by the fact that she seemed to know what I was doing in another room, and I couldn't make any sense of it. I thought if I told people about this, they'd think I was crazy too.
Yes.
So I didn't tell anyone about it. And I just assumed that I would figure it out sooner or later. And the more I looked into it, the harder it became to understand things. And over the years since then, we've tested one after another physical hypothesis, lack of oxygen, drugs given to patients, and so forth. And none of them turned out to be good explanations.
Yeah.
For example, we've studied oxygen levels in people as they come close to death. And it turns out that those who report near-death experiences actually have better oxygen supply to the brain than those who don't have near-death experiences or NDEs. So that clearly isn't the answer. And one after another hypothesis was shot down, and we don't have a physical explanation yet for near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm. When you refer to yourself as a scientist, what science do you think of yourself as expert in?
Neuroscience. I was raised I was trained in neuroscience and psychiatry. I think medical science is a science, even though it's not something you often can do controlled experiments on. You can't assign people to have a near-death experience or not, and then manipulate variables. Either they have them or they don't.
Right.
But you don't have to do experiments to do science. I mean, we can't do experiments on distant stars, but we can make rigorous observations and have a science of astronomy.
Well put. When I got to know Dr. Moody a little bit, he's been on this program, and I've met him, you know, at all the different conferences that one can go to, especially IONS. His training was both in medicine, but also he had a PhD in philosophy.
Yes, yes.
And he and I studied the same kind of philosophy. I'm a Dominican, and we one of our great lights is Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And whether you want to or not, you study a lot of Thomas Aquinas. I was a piano student for 8 years in childhood, and to me, Aquinas was like playing scales. I never really enjoyed it the way that a lot of the other guys in the classroom did. I felt like I was, but it was good for my brain. It would train me well to be a good thinker. that and Aquinas taught that theology was the queen of the sciences because it studied the most noble object that could be studied. And so even though my degrees are in theology, it's with a scientific bent.
Right.
Not just a liberal art necessarily.
Yeah. I think Raymond Moody's background in philosophy, particularly Greek philosophy, was what spurred this whole near-death research movement. Because when he started hearing accounts from his patients when he was in medical school, it reminded him of the accounts in Plato's, Republic and other Greek accounts.
Yes.
And he thought, well, this isn't something new. This is something that's been around with us for centuries. So he started taking them seriously. And then once he published his book, other people did too.
And then late in his life, that still just thrills him. He really lights up when he starts talking about the connectedness of stories from the Greeks to what's cutting edge in ions and consciousness studies and so on. That's when he really lights up.
Right.
Well, when you met him did you know him while he was writing Life After Life?
No. He had written those when he was still in medical school. Mm-hmm. And then he came to University of Virginia to do his psychiatric training. And then the book was finally published.
And was it 75, 76? I was in college, an undergraduate at the time, but I remember devouring it.
Yeah, it was first published in 75 by Mockingbird Press on St. Simon's Island, Georgia. And just a few copies were published.
Yeah.
Then within a year, someone at Bantam read it, loved it, bought the rights, and they sold 3 million copies the first year.
Yes. Well, I bought one of those. I think I shared it around too. I just found it so fascinating. Well, you noted that reading his book gave you some sort of permission to step out of the shadows or something. Yes. How would you describe that part of your life?
Well, I thought it would be a simple physical explanation, but I had to find it. So I started collecting cases and started trying to collect them from other cultures, other religions, to see what features were common, regardless of people's background. And out of that, eventually, we developed the near-death experience scale, the NDE scale, which had 16 items that seemed to be common across cultures. Yeah. And with that, to sort of quantify or identify near-death experiences, we could then do experiments or rigorous observations of different physical variables and correlate them with the presence or absence of a near-death experience or NDE.
Is there a simple place where listeners and viewers can find that 16-item scale?
Probably the best source is just to go to my website, www.brucegrayson.com, and I've got references there to everything that I've ever done.
Okay.
All
right. I'm asking partly for myself because I have a new project coming up where I want a handy referent like that, a simple project where I'd be introducing people to the topic in an uncommon way.
Yeah.
What was it like in your professional life to begin associating with Raymond Moody and becoming known as somebody that was beginning? Did you start journal articles or publishing anything? You did?
Yep. Yeah, the coin of the realm for academic physicians is publishing in medical journals.
Yes.
So I did that. And that actually gave me some credibility, gave near-death experiences some credibility within physicians. The attitude has changed dramatically in the time I've been doing this.
Yes.
When we first started talking about near-death experiences at the American Medical Association and other conferences like that back in the 1980s, nobody knew what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And most people thought we were either being fooled by a few patients or just making it up. But there'd be a polite, silence in the audience. Now, when we talk to the same groups, we usually have doctors standing up in the audience saying, "Let me tell you about my near-death experience."
Exactly.
So it's very common now. And doctors and nurses universally agree that it is something that definitely happens to their patients with fair frequency. There's still a lot of legitimate skepticism about what their ultimate meaning is or what causes them. But no one doubts that they are real experiences that have profound effects on people's lives.
Mm-hmm. When you say that people try to explain them in different ways, what are some of the, there probably is only a few different categories that most of those explanations fall in. What are some of them?
Well, there are large categories like physical explanations and spiritual explanations and psychological explanations. But within those, there are innumerable subcategories of how do we explain this? And, you know, as the technology develops to study the brain, we can test more and more of these theories. And as I said, you know, we've tested all the ones we've tested so far have not shown to be legitimate. Or explanations for near-death experiences. But of course, we're just scratching the surface. And I can't say that we won't find an explanation 20 years from now or 100 years from now. But right now, we're a long way. But, you know, it seems as if we're taught that the mind is what the brain does and that all our thoughts and feelings and perceptions are created by the brain. And in near-death experiences, the brain is at least diminished, if not stopped entirely. And yet people say they have the most vivid thoughts and perceptions that they've ever had. Mm-hmm. And that should not happen if the brain is creating our thoughts. And I should add that this isn't the only example of a phenomenon where the brain is shutting down and consciousness expands. It happens in something called terminal lucidity, in which people who have end-stage dementia, like Alzheimer's disease,
yes,
have not been able to communicate or recognize family for months or years, suddenly become totally lucid and can recognize people, carry on conversations, become animated, and then within hours or days, they die.
Yes.
There's no medical explanation for this. We've also done neuroimaging studies in the last 20 years with people having psychedelic drug trips. And we used to think that the way these drugs work is by stimulating the brain to hallucinate. But what we're finding is that the more elaborate mystical and spiritual experiences with these drugs are associated with a decrease in brain activity. So again, it's like the brain is pulling back, allowing the mind to flourish.
I've heard some try to explain it like the brain might be something like the electrical transformer at the end of your block. You ever heard anybody talk that way?
Right. There's this model that the brain doesn't create thoughts, but sort of filters them. And this goes back to Hippocrates 2,000 years ago, who wrote that the brain is the interpreter of the mind.
Yeah.
And people have used different metaphors as technology develops. These used to be called a filter. And in the 20th century, they started talking about it as a receiver or a transmitter.
Yes.
An example would be a radio receiver or a television set.
Right.
It doesn't create the show, but it receives the signals and transduces them into something that you can understand. And without the television set, you usually can't see the show, but the set isn't creating the show.
Right.
And likewise, the idea is that the thoughts are somewhere out there in the mind, which is not in the physical body. And what the brain does is take these thoughts and feelings and perceptions and translates them into electrical chemical signals that the body can understand and use.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that similar one that I was referencing imagines a power plant somewhere, you know, right, maybe 100 or 200 miles from where you live, where the power at that station is enormously large, and then there's a high tension line that carries it over some space, and then some substation that breaks it down, and then at the end of your street, a transformer that gets it down to a form that your toaster or your hairdryer can use.
Right, right. Yeah. And of course, you know, strict materialists say, well, where is that ultimate source of the electricity, or in our case, the mind? Where is it if it's not in the body? And we don't have a scientific answer for that. On the other hand, their explanation that the brain creates the mind is also inexplicable. We have not the slightest idea how a physical or chemical process in the brain can create a thought. No one's ever come close to having a hint of a clue of an idea of how to explain that.
Mm.
So either way you look at it, whether it's a product of the brain or something outside the brain, we can't fully explain it scientifically yet.
Mm. What are you most excited about right now? What kind of research or work are you doing? One of the things I love about a university is that you get to be emeritus. And then you're not just told to go sit down and shut up. You're probably doing something amazing. What's the amazing thing you're doing now?
Well, I'm pleased to say that Now, as I get older and towards the end of my journey here, there are a lot of younger people who are now coming to help out or replace me, and they're doing things that I would never be able to do. They have different backgrounds, different areas of expertise that I didn't have. So the field is going to really blossom in the next several decades. But I'm looking more and more at the practical applications of near-death experiences as I'm reaching sort of the end of my career and thinking, what good is all this? I mean, it's interesting intellectually, but how can we use it? And what I'm looking at mostly is, how does it affect the people who have these experiences, especially those who have difficulty coming back to a, quote, normal life after they've experienced this otherworldly environment?
Yes.
And what helps them accept these things, integrate them into their lives, and what doesn't help them?
Yes.
Also, how does it affect the families and culture in general? And as part of that, we're also looking at, what do doctors and nurses think about these experiences? Because those are the people that usually hear them first from their patients.
Yes.
And do they think they're worth investigating? And if not, what are the barriers to them taking these things seriously and talking to their patients about them?
Mm-hmm. I think the IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, has a convention each year. And yes, the planners always create a theme for that particular convention. And I think not this year, but the previous one, that was the theme about the after effects or the long-term effects of having had an ND. Did you have a hand in choosing that
theme? No. I was one of the founders of IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, but I haven't been involved in it in the leadership for quite a few years now.
Well, you can take a bow. You did that for a long time. That's one of those things you can turn over to other people.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very interested in, as a Christian and as a minister of Jesus Christ, dead and risen. I'm interested in the number of people who are churchgoers and active in faith bodies who are not at all sold on the idea that they will really survive their death. That's a population that I'm around all the time.
Yeah. It's still surprising. If they take their faith seriously, they think they wouldn't have doubts.
It's not a matter of judging them. It's just, I will be in front of a church group in a few days. And not just in worship, but in a seminar style place where there's interaction and teaching and things. And I always ask them I make them do a forced choice. I say, let's pretend we're in kindergarten. We're all going to put our heads on the desk. And you're only going to raise your hand once when I call the right number. But on a scale of 10 to 1, 10 being very strong, 1 being not very strong, where do you land on the question of, will you be you after you die? And then, Bruce, they fight me. They say, what does that even mean? What do you mean, living after we die? Or, you know, so we spend 2 or 3 minutes on that. And then I just say, okay, enough already. We've exhausted that question. I think you understand it. It's not that hard to understand. Will you ever be able to say, I never saw that bus coming? Boy, that cancer was awful. I'm glad that's over with. Will there be reunions with loved ones? Let's just get cut to the chase. Do you believe it or do you not? And to what degree? My background is social sciences, is a sociology and social science, and social scientists are always trying to calibrate intangibles.
Right.
To figure out the strength of a feeling or an emotion or an idea. So there are, in a group of people that are churchgoers and that are there on a Monday. Now, how many churchgoers go to church on Monday or Tuesday to the extra thing that I'm there to do? Well, it's already a subset of a population that, first of all, goes to church and goes regularly and then chooses to do this extra thing. And those only, when I call out the number 10, about a quarter of the room raises their hand.
Really?
And usually not the pastor or whoever it was that hired me. That person will be a 9. And then I'll go down to 8. By the time I get to about 7, about 40 to 50% of the room has raised their hand. And then as I move down, it never fails. the person who had the keys to the church that came early and started the coffee, turned on the air conditioner or the heat, is a two. It happens all the time. There's these people that are just so faithful in around their church practice, but they just can't get themselves to go to that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, what I've learned from working with near death experiences for so long, and for psychiatric patients as well, is that you don't change your beliefs because of things you've been taught or things you've read or things you've learned.
Yes.
You change because of things you've experienced.
Correct.
So if you've had a personal experience of the divine, that's very persuasive to you.
Yes.
If you read about it, well, maybe yes, maybe no. You know, it's maybe convincing. I'm not positive about it. It's like trying to decide whether food tastes good by reading the menu. You know, I really need to taste it to know.
Good, good. Yeah.
And I think, you know, near-death experiences almost universally say, I know that death is not the end. I know that I will continue after death.
Yeah. I like that menu thing. May I use that?
Yeah, sure. Sure. It wasn't mine.
That's a, well, okay. You've already borrowed it from somebody else. Good. Well, it's true. And true things just bear repeating. It's one of the things I've enjoyed most in my life. I've been a campus minister much of my career, and I used to lead our Catholic Campus Ministry Association nationally. And, when we do like exit interviews of students that were active in campus ministry during their, at least their undergraduate years, they very often say service projects that are experiential,
yep,
and retreats that are experiential were the most important formative things along the way. So I've spent a lot of time, especially on retreat work, and continue to do it with people not affiliated with colleges, because there you have an opportunity to help people have experiences because they set the time aside.
Yeah.
I believe the divine is ready to engage anyone who is not scrolling on their phone. Anybody that will set a little time aside, I believe the divine, however you understand it, will find a way in.
Yeah. There have been a number of people who have tried to teach courses in college about near-death experiences and then look at whether people are changed by that. And the most successful one was one put on by the late Chuck Flynn at Miami University of Ohio, in which he had as part of his course a requirement that the students go out into the street and find someone they did not know and do some unexpected good deed for them and help someone out who seemed to be in trouble that they didn't know at all. And he found that people who actually engaged in that process were changed a lot more by the course than those who didn't do that.
Oh. Even though it didn't have to do with near death?
It had to do just with unconditional love, taking care of someone that you didn't have a responsibility for.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, many near-death experiencers come back saying that in their NDE, they experience themselves as being part of something that everyone is a part of, and that we're all interconnected.
Yes.
They talk about like being a wave in the ocean being the divine, and you're part of it. You're composed of the same material the ocean is, but for a time being here, you've got a separate structure as the wave. And you know that someday you're going to melt back into the ocean and not be a discrete wave anymore. For the time being, you are, but you're composed of the same thing. And they come back from the near-death experience realizing that they're the same as everybody else. And they're interconnected with everybody else. So that when you are nice to someone, if you help someone out, you're helping yourself as well. And if you hurt someone, you're hurting someone else as well. Which, of course, is what we call the golden rule, which is part of every religion we have.
Of course.
But for the near-death experience, there's not just a rule you're supposed to follow. They have experienced it as a law of the universe. This is the way it works. This is the way it is.
Yeah.
And you can't avoid it.
Have you seen anything in your studies and experience about the difference between people from collective cultures as opposed to more Western individualistic cultures and how they experience a near-death experience?
That's a great question, Father Nathan. I think the difference is not in what they experience, but how they interpret it, make sense out of it, and describe it. For example, most people will describe being in the presence of some warm, loving entity that makes them feel unconditionally loved. And people who grew up in a Judeo-Christian society will quickly label that as God. Mm-hmm. But people from Eastern cultures will not give it that label, but they'll ascribe the same thing.
Yes.
But not give it that same label.
Right.
And you see that for one after another aspect of the near-death experience, they will describe the same basic phenomenon, but call it something different.
Yes. Because I'm a Christian and a Catholic, the way I try to help people that I'm around is through the idea of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you must have seen us do this, in the name of the Father, yeah. Son, and Holy Spirit, yeah. and the Trinity having these three persons in one Godhead. But the one that most people, it's another forced choice thing. I'll ask people, when you compose a prayer, who are you talking to? Who's on the other side of it in the exchange? Is it the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, or in the Catholic world, Mary or one of the saints is another category that might pertain. But if I just stay with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I'll ask for a show of hands, and then I'll say, look around the room so you know the community in which you live. Your brothers and sisters do it this way. And the number one, the Father, is always the gold. Jesus, the second person in the Trinity, is always the silver. And the poor Holy Spirit is a very distant third, bronze. It happens all the time. So what I try to do is say, have you ever rediscovered a person you already know or learned something about them after having been around them a long time that just blows you away? That's the Holy Spirit. And so I try to help them open that category and say, it's been here all along. Could we play around in here? And that's where your career and mine might overlap, where we're trying to help people imagine things in ways that open up new possibilities. When I took chose to do this podcast, we had a little team helping me, and we chose this name, the Joyful Friar. I'm a Dominican. Saint Dominic was our founder, and that was his nickname. He never called himself that, but other people called him that. And when I was looking at the bewildering number of religious orders there are in different ways to be in Catholic ministry, when I learned that he was the Joyful Friar, I stopped looking. I just said, I don't want to be any of these crown of thorns ones or drops of blood and crucifixes and stuff. Not that I don't love those aspects of the faith, but I just didn't want to make an identity out of sorrow. And so I thought I'd rather go towards joy. So my brand has kind of become joy. So would you share with our listeners and viewers what has given you joy over the course of your career and what's giving you joy in your current moment?
Well, I think it comes down to basically helping people and helping them understand what they are about. You know, a lot of people come back from an unusual experience, like a near-death experience, wondering whether did this really happen or was I briefly crazy? And by validating it for them and not giving them an answer, but helping them find the answer within themselves, they come to terms with who they are and why they're here on this planet, in this physical body. And I think that gives them a sense of connection to the meaning and purpose that they got in the near-death experience, but we're not sure they can retain once they're back here in the body. And I think I'm getting a lot of joy now out of seeing similar changes in my fellow healthcare workers, seeing them come to terms with this experience and realizing it's not just a hallucination, it's something that really happens and really makes a difference in our lives.
Yeah. And would you, I kind of tried to do that as a two-part question, past and present. Is there a present joy that you have the leisure to do now that you didn't before, or that just at this point in your long life, what gives you joy when you wake up in the morning?
What's different now is that I've got the joy in knowing that the next generation of researchers is already at work continuing this work. It's not going to die when I die.
Yeah, I'm sure that's satisfying. Well, speaking of you dying, what do you think about that? Do you have any anticipated thoughts or feelings, emotions around what happens when you die?
I do. I mean, I was never afraid of dying. Even when I thought it was just annihilation, that wasn't a scary thought to me.
Yeah.
But now I'm fairly sure that I will survive in some form. You know, most near-death experiencers, when you ask them to tell you about the experience, they start by saying, well, there really aren't any words to describe it.
Yes.
And we researchers say, great, tell me about it, you know.
Of course you do.
So, you know, we force them to use metaphors and to distort it in order to get it across to us. So I think that whatever they tell me is really a metaphor for what they really experienced.
Yes.
And the experience, I think, is probably something that I can't imagine until you actually been there and experienced it.
Yes.
So I think that I will survive. I wouldn't be at all surprised if I find myself surviving.
All right.
I'm looking forward to being surprised at what form that takes.
Would you call that joyful hope?
Yes, I would.
That's a phrase I use a lot. In fact, it's borrowed from the Catholic Mass. Have you ever been at a Catholic Mass?
Oh, it's been decades. Yes.
Well, if you're not a Catholic and you're at a Catholic funeral or wedding or for whatever reason, you're there for Christmas or Easter or whatever, we stand up and we recite the Lord's Prayer, but there are different versions of it that different Protestants and Catholics use according to translations of the Bible and so on. Well, in a Catholic Mass, we get to the part that says, deliver us from evil. And the Protestants will keep going and say, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. And the Catholics have stopped. And if I'm leading a Mass, there's a little prayer that I'm supposed to say that's actually called the embolism. Isn't that a weird word for a prayer?
Yeah.
It sounds like it would kill you, but it doesn't. It just means expansion. And why we thought the Lord's Prayer needed expanding, I don't have any idea. But somebody came along and said, here, we're going to expand it in this way. And it's a little phrase that only the priest says. And it goes like this. Deliver us, Lord, from every evil. Check. All those in favor? Deliver us, Lord, from every evil. Grant us peace in our day. In your mercy, keep us free from sin. Protect us from all anxiety. You must have dealt with a lot of anxiety as a clinician. And as we wait in joyful hope for the coming of our Savior, Jesus Christ. And that's that little phrase has become my byline. That you don't have to wake up cheerful today because it's sunny or not. And whatever it is that is wrong or bad or painful, it'll pass. It really will. Yeah. I do believe that Good Friday is only 3 days from Easter morning. You know, just hang in there.
I think you feel that from near-death experiences as well. No matter what is going on in their lives, they constantly have that joyful hope, and they have that feeling of gratitude no matter what happens to them.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me give you one opportunity to leave a closing remark. If you want my audience to remember any one thing that you said, what is it?
Well, I'm not going to limit it to one thing.
All right. Go ahead. No, you're the guest.
Everyone to remember that these are not unusual experiences. They're very common. That most studies have shown that about 5% of the general population has had a near-death experience. That's one out of every 20 people.
Yeah.
So someone you work with, someone in your classroom, someone in your extended family has had a near-death experience.
Yes.
And they are not in any way related to mental illness. They're normal experiences that happen to normal people under abnormal circumstances.
Yeah.
They have profound after effects. People are never the same after these experiences. And sometimes you need to help them deal with those after effects and how they can adapt them, integrate them into their current life. They also raise questions about the mind and the brain, about whether the mind can continue when the brain has stopped working. And that leads to the next question of, does that mean the mind continues after the body dies completely? And it certainly suggests that in terms of near-death experiences, that the mind keeps going, in fact, flourishes when it's out of the body.
Yeah. All right. Well done. Well done.
Thank you.
I want to have one little side conversation with you before the Zoom call ends. But for right now, I'm so grateful for your presence here, Dr. Bruce Grayson. And I hope we can do it again sometime, or that we meet up somewhere at a IONS conference or something else.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Father Nathan, for this opportunity.
All right. So viewers and listeners, thank you for being with us. Remember that I'm praying for you. I care about what's important to you. And if there's a way that I can be of any kind of assistance to you, you can find me through my website, nathan-castle.com. Just go to the comments part. I don't remember the name of it, but contact us or whatever it says. You know, send me a little email. And if there's something that I can do for you, I would be at your service. But for now, that's this episode of The Joyful Friar. Thanks for being with us. God bless you. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Joyful Friar. Please like, follow, and subscribe. You can visit me at nathan-castle.com. Send me a message by clicking the contact button. God bless.